know that the vast majority of people who eat chocolate Easter bunnies start with the ears? Just thought I'd give you that little fun fact. On this Easter day and the end of Passover, we want to talk a little bit about how the law in our country intersects with religion, how the freedom of religion clause in our Constitution has been interpreted over the years on many topics, such as gay marriage, contraception, the right not to be vaccinated, wearing of religious garb, school prayer, if I haven't mentioned that. And with us to discuss this issue is one of the best people to do that, one of the foremost experts in the country on freedom of religion, Professor Robin Fretwell Wilson. She is a law professor at the University of Illinois College of Law and the director of Institute of Government and Public Affairs. She has written 13 books, including our most recent book, Religion, Freedom, LGBT Rights, and the Prospect for Common Ground. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me. Hi.
Hey, Karen. It's Robin. Thank you. Sorry,
okay.
I'm sitting somewhere where there are a few other folks, but how are you? Thank you for having me.
Okay, doing well. All right, so can you tell our listeners just basically what the Constitution says about religion and what it means for the average person?
Well, so there are hundreds of books written on that. It's a big topic. But, you know, the basic thrust of the First Amendment is that the government can neither establish religion nor can it impinge on the free exercise of religion. And of course, across the centuries, that's been interpreted by the Supreme Court and lower courts. And we can talk about that in some of the questions that you have. But the basic idea is that the government should not be trying to favor one religious, you know, sect over another. And neither should it be blocking people from, you know, basically the exercise of their religion when it doesn't harm other people.
And so, and this has obviously taken a lot of different forms, and it's been at issue in many cases over the years. And I'm just going to take a recent one because it seems like there's always a freedom of religion case somewhere. But there was just a recent one this past week where apparently there was a public celebration. People were doing the Stations of the Cross, and I believe it was in our Capitol in Washington, D.C. They were kneeling for prayer, and they had been granted a permit, and they weren't blocking traffic, according to the news reports, and they were asked to leave. How would the, I mean, obviously you don't know how this is going to end up or whether there's going to be a lawsuit, but how would a court look at that issue? You've been asked to leave, you're praying, you're doing something religious. How would the court look at this?
Well, you have questions on both sides of that. You know, one issue on one side is whether that's an establishment of religion by having these Stations of the Cross in front of the Capitol. Imagine that you were a member of the Jewish faith and you saw that. Would you feel excluded by that? Would you feel let down? So that's one issue. You know, the second side of that is people have the right to exercise their religion. They went through all the correct processes to do so. You know, they obtained a permit. They weren't harming anybody. And, you know, if the Capitol allows other groups that have, let's say, political affiliation to do this kind of thing in front of the Capitol, if the U.S. government allows that, then it would seem like they would need to allow people of faith on the same basis. And
okay.
The permitting process does that. So you're always sort of caught between these twin forces, the right to exercise your religion, and then when the government allows that in a neutral forum, whether, you know, that somehow implies that the government endorses, you know, the Stations of the Cross as opposed to, you know, other religious symbols or other religious traditions.
I'm going to take a break. There's kind of a bad connection here. I'm going to see if maybe you can get in a better place. But let me take a break. When we come back, I'm going to talk about an interesting case that has to do with a person who was on death row and was about to be executed and wanted to have a minister present, and a surprising verdict, in my view, from the U.S. Supreme Court about whether or not a person is entitled to that. We'll be back in a minute. This is WGN. Welcome back. We're here with Professor Robin Fretwell Wilson of the University of Illinois College of Law, my alma mater, and we're talking about freedom of religion, and we're kind of whipping through some of the important decisions and interesting decisions regarding how the freedom of religion constitutional provision impacts us as a people. Thank you again for joining us, Professor. Let's talk about this case that just came down from the U.S. Supreme Court about a death row inmate who said that he wanted to have a spiritual advisor during his execution. Can you tell our listeners what the Supreme Court said about this?
Yeah, Karen, thank you. Well, you know, in some sense, this is a question of whether the government's shown enough burden to explain why it cannot do that. So if it allows other people to be present at the time of an execution, but a spiritual advisor was not being allowed to be present, then there's a real question for why that is. And that seems like a classic instance of infringement on freedom of religion. What's interesting, free exercise of religion, what's interesting is that prior courts, before Justice Barrett was added to the court, prior courts on the Supreme Court had sort of punted this or kicked the can down the road. And I think they were fairly evenly split. There were some pretty significant dissents talking about security in the administration of the execution and the administration of the prisons. But one thing that's particularly important in this case is we have something called RLUIPA, which is the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. And that was a place where Congress said to the prison system, we understand that you have concerns about the administration of the prisons, but you still need to allow, and give you some examples, a Muslim to kneel on a mat and to give them the things that they need to pray, even if they're in prison. Other things that RLUIPA has been used to do is to say that if a person needs to keep kosher in order to be close to God, that they should be given the diet to do that. And so in some places, this isn't just the Constitution at play. It's an announcement or a pronouncement by Congress that where we can accommodate the spiritual belief of people, even in prison, we should do so.
And again, you know, that's a good point that, it, you know, as a lot of people, you know, have the position like, I don't care about prisoners, they're in jail. But it is symbolic for the rest of us. And like you said, if we can make sure that people have their rights, even in a prison situation, then that kind of bodes well for preserving rights for us when we're not in prison. Prayer in school, you know, gets a lot of play. And I'm not going to even begin to go through all of the decisions and all of the issues in prayer in school. But can you summarize sort of where we are as far as are we allowed to have any prayer in school? Are we allowed to have moments of silence? Can children organize themselves for private prayer? What is kind of the state of the law?
Well, that's like a worthy of a whole treatise.
Yes, I know. I agree.
But let me do what I can.
Okay.
With that one. But, you know, I think in some sense this is intuitive and common sense. Okay. So a moment of prayer doesn't endorse any particular religion. It's not pro-Jesus or pro-Muhammad. You know, it's a sign of the significance of religious faith and introspection and spirituality and peace for all of us. And especially during COVID, you can think about how that mindfulness, like today in a modern world, we might call that mindfulness or well-being, but that's really key. So, like, you know, a moment of silence, that's not going to be an endorsement of any particular thing. It might even be seen as a possible mental health protective. When you get to things like, you know, the school club, so is a school club in school space actually praying? Well, you know, if the school opens its space to all kinds of other things, we're seeing the U.S. Supreme Court say that, you know, people of faith should be entitled to participate in those things that the government provides as a good on an equal basis. So you couldn't have only the Bible club needs here kind of rule. But you could have a rule that said, okay, if, you know, the sewing club and the after-school karate club and this club and that club and the other club and Bible club all meet in this space on the same neutral ground, it doesn't feel like an endorsement by the government. It feels wildly different. And I think intuitively the cases are tracking along that. Now, that's a long ways, Karen, from when I came through the University of Illinois. I'm dating myself. But, you know, as a child, contemporaries of mine will remember just at the edges of their memories being asked to say a prayer together in school. And, you know, it's a really difficult point for people who were agnostic or atheist or kids who hadn't even decided for themselves whether they believed in God, because it's a symbol of government telling them to pray. And so I think that the key here is religious people can't be treated better or worse than the rest of the folks, but that they should be entitled to meet, and especially if it's not coming from any pressure source or source of power that's identified with the state. So if students themselves want to, you know, circle the flag out front and say a prayer, they're going to be able to do that.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, there's so many sides and aspects to freedom of religion. And, you know, I'm just putting myself in the position of a parent who may have strong religious beliefs. You know, even though I may think that prayer in school is a good thing, I maybe don't want my teachers and my school telling my kids how to pray. Maybe I want to do that at home. Maybe that's my purview as a parent. And even though I'm in favor of religion and I'm in favor of my children praying, I don't really want my government to get involved in it. So it's not always the anti-religious people. It's sometimes the religious people don't want the government involved.
I think that's right, Karen. I mean, it's sort of ironic and against conventional wisdom,
right,
in a sense. But if you think about one of the things that's been a testament to this country since its beginning, is that we've been a place where Catholic colonists could settle in Maryland and Puritans could settle in Rhode Island. And, you know, you could be in Virginia and parts of Virginia, you could be a Baptist, and other parts of Virginia, you could be, you know, a different tradition of Protestant. And we've allowed those thousand flowers to grow. That's a typical trope of religious liberty. And so even though we're deeply, deeply divided as a people over maybe what's the most profound question, is there a maker? And what's our relationship to that maker, if there is one? Even though we're so divided about that, we have, as a national project, found a way to be well with each other. And it's by saying that the government should not be in charge of deciding what is that profound truth, what is the ultimate truth. So I think you're right. I think there are people who care very, very deeply about faith that guides them in every aspect of their life, and they would still resist the government imprinting a particular view on everyone else.
We have so many topics here. Let's just do a real quick bullet point on the issue of vaccinations. I've been asked, let's just say your employer mandates vaccinations. I've not really heard of any employers doing that to date. But let's just say they do, and let's just say you have a legitimate religious belief that that vaccinations are wrong. What would be your right in the workplace? What would be your right to challenge that based upon the freedom of religion clause?
Well, let me back up, and even before we get to the Constitution, remind everybody that there are different levels of law, okay? And we have something called statutory positive law. You'll remember from, you know, you're a practicing attorney, you know well. And sometimes the thing that matters most here is statutes as opposed to this sort of super statute, the Constitution. And in the statutes, we see that before COVID, 47 states had religious and philosophical exemptions to vaccination for the enrollment of students in school. Okay, now during COVID, we've seen that backwalked by three states. We've seen an interesting project by the District of Columbia, which wrote a new rule that I consider a kind of smash up between a mature minor doctrine and an exemption. But basically it says if parents don't want to treat their child with the vaccine for philosophical or religious reasons, the child can decide to get that. So we're seeing a shift among the states in their positive laws about this idea of people's religious views vis-a-vis the public health, frankly, of the rest of the society. But that generally has been about kids. What we have not seen during COVID is any single state mandate vaccination. Instead, as you said, Karen, it often is your employer, or if you work for a healthcare facility, the facility, you know, saying, look, you know, to be here working as a nurse's aide, you're going to have a vaccination. Now, most people eyeball that and they think that makes sense. You're like in a healthcare context where you could spread disease or you could be, you know, really adversely affected by the disease. And so it's not always that the employers are looking out for their market so much as looking out, in fact, for the employee themselves. But in this particular case, if I'm an employee, let's say I work for a healthcare facility, just to use the quintessential example, and I don't want to be vaccinated. You know, the first cut of this is going to be whether there's any positive statute that says that I don't have to be vaccinated. And then the second cut of that might be the U.S. Constitution. But I think when believers go there, they're not going to find the comfort that they might think they get when the Constitution says that the free exercise of religion shall not be impinged. And I'll give you an example of why. So there's a very famous case you may remember from law school, the Peyote case, right? So it's Employment Division versus Smith. But there were these folks who ingested peyote as a matter of their religious tradition. And then some of them got fired because that was illegal drug use in the state of Oregon. And so they said, hey, I was fired, but it was really for religious reasons. I want unemployment compensation. That rocks itself all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in a decision authored by Justice Scalia, the arch-conservative Justice Scalia, literally said, no, you're not entitled to unemployment compensation. And the reason why is because if we allowed you, the peyote ingester, to do that, but everybody else couldn't ingest peyote because it's hallucinogenic, then religious believers would become a law unto themselves. Now, if your employer is a federal agency, then after Smith, lots of people went to Congress and said, this doesn't make sense for religious groups. They're disproportionately impacted by lots and lots of rules. So we should have a heightened standard of review for religious impacts. And that gave us something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Professor, we're going to have to take a break now. I'm sorry, but thank you so much for joining us. There's so much to talk about. You're going to have to come back again, and we'll address some of the issues that we haven't addressed. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor, and we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be taking your legal questions.